What's up, people? It's that time again. WGN, let's join the two friends. Jason Whiteside and Rich Lankoff in a legal face-off. Hear the knowledge they got. Legal point and counterpoint, Jay, you know the drill. From sports to Hollywood and the politics world. Not forgetting current events that occur. Plus a couple jabs here and there. Yeah. Airman, listen on WGNplus.com. Airman, listen on WGNplus.com. And join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter. Or send us an email with questions, we hear ya. Yeah, one love, you know. The lawyer's in the house.
Welcome to
Legal Face Off,
starring Jason Whiteside and Rich Lankoff.
Now your host, Sam Panionovich.
Quite the introduction leading us into Legal Face-Off on WGN Plus, where the legal eagles hit on all the topics that you need to hear. It's Rich Lankoff and Jason Whiteside. I am Sam Panionovich. Five guests today on the docket, including our biweekly segment Inside Out. But we start with some breaking news from Friends of the Parks. And Fred Bates is in studio with us at WGN, the board policy co-chair of Friends of the Parks. Good morning. How are you?
I am fine. In fact, great.
Right. Well, as of yesterday, February 4th, after a court appearance before U.S. District Court Judge John Dara, Friends of the Parks' fight to keep the proposed Lucas Museum of Narrative Art off the lakefront is set to continue. What does this mean?
Well, essentially what it means is we've defeated the two efforts by the city and the park district to try and get this case thrown out before it got underway. So they still have not answered our complaint. So this is obviously pretty normal legal process, and it takes a long time. But now the judge has said enough of the wrestling at the initial set of issues, and let's move forward with the case.
All right, before we jump into the legal arguments with the motions that Judge Dara ruled on, can you just tell us what is Friends of the Park and what your purpose is?
Friends of the Parks is a 40-year-old organization that came into existence when the disparities of the, shall we say, the handling by the Park District of Parks in minority neighborhoods and other neighborhoods was very apparent, and the federal government was going to pursue that issue in a court context, and we were the ones who came into existence and were created to help bring equity to the park system on a cross-the-city basis.
All right, and then you got involved in this lawsuit when the city of Chicago entered into a deal with the Lucas Museum for a land lease that was effectively almost 300 years, potentially, right?
Yes, and one of the arguments we made in this case, which the judge accepted, is that this isn't a lease. It, in every legal sense, this is a transfer of this property.
So the judge talked about whether the Lucas Museum was for the public benefit. Judge Dara discussed that. Judge Dara is my former trial advocacy judge, great judge, great guy in general. Can you explain to us what this public benefit concept means?
It's one of these things that you could wrestle with for a month, but the sort of question is, how much is this of benefit to the public, and how much does it really benefit a private individual? And the judge accepted our premise that at this point, it's pretty clear that this has a lot of benefit to private interests. The city and the park district, for example, don't get a thing out of the arrangement with Lucas. His private entity here retains all of the ownership of the art, all of the proceeds. There's nothing that comes to the city or the park district in this deal.
I mean, except you could argue, and you know, the counter argument and the one made by the Lucas Museum is what the public is benefiting from is having access to art. And a lot of people have sort of derided the Lucas Museum as Star Wars memorabilia. That's not, to be fair, what it is. It's a museum of narrative art. So isn't that, why is that not for the public benefit? Just having access, again, to a privately funded museum, not one that's not taking public funds, why is that not for the public benefit?
Well, Lucas has his own sense of what his art is. The concept of narrative art is a very ephemeral one. Nobody on this planet, I think, could tell you what narrative art means, not even George Lucas, I'm guessing. But in this context, George Lucas is like other private museum people like the Terra Museum and the Harding Museum and so on. The likelihood that this will survive a very short period of time, let's say maybe it's got currency for 5 or 10 years, and then I think the bloom is off the rose of the Star Wars phenomena. And at that point, we're left with a huge albatross on our lakefront and a very bad legacy for the city. And it then will become just how apparent that this is a private interest and not a public one. Lucas has no public involvement in any aspect of this project. There are no public members on his board. There's no public control. He and the people he appoints to his board have absolute control over this whole process from beginning to end.
So we should note that for our listeners who may not be familiar with, you know, we have listeners all around the world who may be not familiar with where the proposed museum is. It's going to be on what is currently being used as a parking lot at Soldier Field for use before Bears games. Now, again, the counter argument is if you win and this space remains in its current use, you're having people drinking and partying before a Bears game on the lakefront. Is that really in the public benefit?
Obviously, we don't think that's a good use either. And the city for several decades now has been promising to turn this entire parcel, and in fact has very detailed plans to do it, into a totally open and public park space. We obviously would like to see that happen. We've been patient on these issues for decades. We worked with other environmental groups, for example, to get the Otter Drive moved. It took 2 decades to get that done. If it takes us another few years to get the city to do what it's already promised, that's the way this sometimes happens. But it isn't right for them to pretend like they're, for example, adding park space when they're building on a 17-acre site and only keeping 5 acres for park space. It's a red herring from our viewpoint.
You know, Judge Darrow wrote in his opinion and talked about the public trust doctrine and why this piece of property is special or should be reserved. Can you just walk us through what that theory was or the philosophy behind it?
Well, the public trust doctrine gets a little esoteric, and since we're on a in a legal framework, let me try it. The public trust doctrine specifically retains all that land which has been recovered from navigable waterways to the highest and best public use. That one can argue what that is over time, but this is a several thousand-year-old doctrine that started under Roman law. It's been continued under U.S. law, and we are trying to keep it focused on our property here on Lake Michigan that belongs to all of us.
All right, so for people that may not know, a portion of that land that's there was actually, it's a landfill or it was recovered.
This every inch of that land has been recovered from the lake. It is, none of it is natural land.
Fred Bates in studio with us on Legal Face-Off WGN Plus. Fred is the board policy co-chair for Friends of the Parks. If I could be blunt for a second, there are some people that probably think, well, why do you guys hate Star Wars? Obviously not true, but how do you respond to that?
Well, you know, none of us hate Star Wars. And in fact, the spouse of our chair, Juanita Irizarry, is a dyed-in-the-wool Star Wars fan. But he even agrees with us that Star Wars is wonderful. We'd like it to be in Chicago, but it should just be in the right place. And there are numerous perfect sites for this museum that won't intrude on our park system.
And again, just to be fair, and I think, Fred, you would admit that, listen, I don't profess to be an expert on narrative art either. I don't think many of us have heard of that before the Lucas Museum. But to be fair, the other side of it is it's much more than Star Wars memorabilia. I think George Lucas owns the largest collection of Norman Rockwell art, of which this will be the primary home. Narrative art, to my understanding, includes, you know, lots of audiovisual types of displays. So it's more than just Star Wars memorabilia. You do feel that it would be okay for this museum to go forward if it was located elsewhere. What if it was located in a park on the west side or near UIC. That's some other alternatives. Would you oppose that as well?
We would oppose having any public property in the parks used for this kind of purpose. We have been consistent on that position, and sometimes we win, sometimes we lose.
Where does Friends of the Park stand on the, you know, some other notable developments that we've seen in Chicago over the last 15 years? I'm thinking of Millennium Park, Maggie Daly Park, Riverwalk here by the Chicago River, and also the upcoming Obama Library Museum. Where does the organization stand on those different developments?
We have had, I think, a meaningful impact on how those projects have developed. For example, we opposed the use of any above-ground areas for the Children's Museum, which was proposed initially to be put in Maggie Daly Park. We wrestled around with that with the various people involved in the Children's Museum, and were unable to reach a place where we and they agreed that the park would not be intruded upon, so that project died. In the case of Millennium Park, we pushed very hard and with, I think, meaningful success to make sure that the Harris Theater stayed at the periphery and at a low profile. And we have continued to make our positions clear and I think have had meaningful success with having those positions upheld.
What are your thoughts on the 606 trail that's now, I think it's Logan Square, Bucktown, the elevated trails and paths?
I think it's sensational, personally. And I think it's doing a little more gentrifying than might make all of us happy, but it's a wonderful trail, and the landscaping is spectacular, and we have been very supportive of that.
What do you? We'll let you go with this question. What do you think Mayor Emanuel's legacy will be when it comes to, and maybe Mayor, you know, his predecessor, Mayor Daly, a lot of this was under his watch. What do you think the legacy is with regards to use of public space for the public interest will be as we look back on this maybe in 20, 30 years or beyond?
Well, I think I think most of the time his heart and his processes are in the right place. The 606 is a wonderful example. The Northerly Island development, which is equally sensational and beautifully done, are two prime examples in what he's done on the Chicago River with the boating access and parks is wonderful. So those parts of his legacy are terrific, and I think we will all look back and say those were great accomplishments. The one thing that we really are troubled by is the obvious one, the Lucas Museum on the lakefront. We think that both Soldiers Field is an albatross that's going to be useless in about 10 to 20 years. The Bears are not going to want to play there, and that then will be another legacy. It's not his legacy, but it's another thing we will have to deal with as a city, and the same thing is true of McCormick Place. That's going to disappear within that same time frame. So our vision is that if Rahm Emanuel would get his arms around the right vision and really do everything he can to see that that part of the lakefront becomes what it should be, which is part of the sort of jeweled necklace that we have along our lakefront, and I think his legacy would be terrific, and I'd love to see that.
Fred Bates, Friends of the Parks, keep fighting the good fight. Thanks
you.
For coming in studio with us.
Thanks. Appreciate it very much.
Thanks, Fred. Take care.
The following information is considered advertising material. You're listening to Rich Lenkoff on Legal Face-Off. Rich is a partner at Bryce Downey & Lenkoff and handles workers' compensation, general liability, and entertainment law. He has been selected to the 2012 Illinois Super Lawyer List and has been named leading lawyer from 2012 through 2016. Rich has been honored as one of the 50 most influential people in workers' compensation by SEAK Incorporated and is a frequent lecturer for many national organizations. Bryce Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service law firm in Illinois and Indiana. Their clients enjoy a hand-picked team of attorneys supported by a world-class staff. Among their other practice areas are business litigation, construction, employment law, insurance coverage, intellectual property, and professional liability. To contact Rich and to learn more about Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, visit bdlfirm.com/WGN.
Legal Face-Off, WGN Plus. I'm Sam Panayotovich. You know the Legal Eagles, Rich Lenkoff and Jason Whiteside. And back to the phones we go. Cannon Lambert is an attorney with Karchmar and Lambert. The website is getthecannon.com, and he joins us now on WGN. Good morning, sir.
Hi, good morning. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Cannon, thanks for joining us. We're here to talk about the Sandra Bland case. Could you tell us what your involvement is, please?
Sure. I'm the lead attorney, for the family, for Sandra Bland's family, and have been kind of helping to shepherd the litigation.
All right. So we've covered the story extensively on Legal Face-Off, but for our listeners who haven't heard it, could you give us a brief background about what happened with Sandra Bland, and then we'll talk about what the latest news is?
Sure. You know, she was a 28-year-old Naperville woman who had gone down to her alma mater, Prairie View A&M, for the purposes of starting a job she had recently received. She was just leaving her school, and in doing so, Trooper Insignia got behind her and was coming up on her in a pretty rapid fashion. She moved over to get out of his way, and he pulled her over. And throughout that exchange, he ultimately asked her, and I want to be clear, he asked her to put out a cigarette, to which she asked him a question as to why it is that she had to put it out. And then from there, things escalated to the point where he ultimately pulled her out of her car, pointed a taser at her saying, "I'm going to light you up," slammed her to the ground, and then arrested her on false pretense. He then transported her to the Waller County Jail, where she was ultimately found dead 3 days later. We've come to know and understand that the officer Insignia, was indicted for perjury, for lying as to why it is that he pulled her out of the car. And so we've been litigating that set of circumstances since then.
So this case got a lot of attention nationally, internationally, for a variety of reasons, one of which was the fact that this exchange between Trooper Insignia and your and Sandra Bland was caught on video. A lot of us saw the video. Videos have been obviously in the news in the last few months involving these kind of situations. Let's talk about the video for a second. Did the police department, the Waller County Sheriff's Department, give up that video? Did they release it right away? Or, as we saw in the Laquan McDonald case here in Chicago, was there some delay in releasing that video?
Well, they did release it, but it wasn't Waller County that did so. It was actually the state police. It was the Department of Public Safety, the equivalent of the state police, that ultimately released it. They did so a couple of weeks after the incident occurred, so there wasn't the sort of delay that we've seen in Laquan McDonald's case. And I think they tried to kind of get out in front of what they understood to be a pretty bad situation for them.
Now, the episode that we see in the video is subject to, or was initially subject to, a lot of discussion. What have you learned since the episode took place, and in light of Trooper Insignia's indictment that, you know, maybe adds some more information more than the video might show?
Well, I would say this. I think that what you said about cameras and their utility is very true. In many of these instances we're seeing right now, because things are caught on camera, it makes things a lot clearer as to what happened, and there's no guesswork. And in this instance, there really was no guesswork. I think what happened, though, is that the media grabbed portions of the video and portions were shared where people didn't get an opportunity to see the entirety of it. If you watch the entirety of the video, what you see is that Sandy was asked to get out of her car. She asked a question in response, and then, without any probable cause, the officer opened her door, slapped her, pointed his taser at her, and forced her out of the car. It's only after that happened that Sandy started to voice her frustrations in ways that people have kind of characterized as combative. So what I've learned is that it's extremely important that there's that there's transparency, and that there's a unilateral transparency. The more that you share with people, the better understanding people have.
Ken, this is Jason. This week there were also some recordings that were released by the Waller County Sheriff's Office, where they had questioned a couple of inmates I don't know if the news is reporting it right, but is it true that there were only two questions asked about marijuana use?
Yeah, the frustrating part of what we found in getting those interviews is that on the 20th of July, the DA for Waller County announced publicly that he was going to be treating Sandy's situation as a murder investigation. 2 days later, he sent his lieutenant for the sheriff's office, the Waller County Sheriff's Office, to go and interview these two women who were inmates in a cell across from Sandy. The only questions that they asked those women had to do with whether or not they had smelled marijuana being consumed by Sandy and whether or not Sandy had spoken about having marijuana on her person. The reason that was so frustrating is because there was a representation publicly that they were going to do one thing, and then when we saw what they actually did, they did quite another. The only thing they asked about was marijuana. They didn't ask anything about whether or not she had had any involvement with guards or interactions with guards that were negative or inmates that were negative, whether or not she had said she was fearful of her for her life, or whether she was contemplating doing anything to herself. They didn't ask any questions about what her emotional state was or whether or not she was eating and if she was explaining why she wasn't eating. They did none of those things. And they were captive in the way of being an audience, that is the two women that were inmates. And they were in proximity where you would have thought that if you were going to do a thorough investigation, you would have done those, you would have asked those sorts of questions.
Now, the Texas Rangers also did their own investigation. Have you been able to get a hold of what their investigative notes were or the audio recordings?
Excuse me. As you know, before we even filed the lawsuit, we had sought out that document, and we ended up having to file because of the way that information was being disseminated. Information was being given to the media, but not to the family. And even when we were making the same request through FOIA that the media was asking for, we weren't getting anything. So we ended up having to file suit for the purposes of trying to obtain information. Even in doing so, they've been blocking the efforts that we've been making to obtain the Texas Ranger report. And in the face of that, in spite of that, they brought motions to try and dismiss our complaint. So what they're effectively saying is, we don't think that you've alleged enough in the way of facts that would rise to the level of a claim. But by the way, even though we're sitting on all of the information associated with what happened, we're not going to give that to you. So we don't think you've done what you're supposed to do, and we're not going to give you the documentation and information necessary for you to fix what we think is wrong. So you're kind of in a catch-22, too bad for you. That's their attitude, and that's what we're recoiling from.
Ken, what's your theory of the case? What do you think happened inside that jail cell? Do you think that the Waller County investigators were negligent? Were they incompetent? Was there race involved? Why do you think, if you know your theory is to be believed and they didn't conduct a thorough interview or investigation, what do you think the motivation behind that was?
Well, the challenge is that we just don't know what exactly happened in the jail, but we do know that when someone's in custody, that they are under the charge and responsibility of the institution that they're in custody within. And so from my standpoint, whether it's that someone did it to her or whether it's that she did it to herself is sort of immaterial, because we are dealing with an in custody death, where the reality of it is that they were responsible for her care, custody, and safety. You know, they had things in the jail that clearly should not have been there, trash bags. And, you know, I'm not sure. They had a huge trash can in the jail. You don't generate that kind of garbage that would require that sort of trash can. Trash bags and all kinds of things that should have never been in the jail. She was reportedly distraught and crying, and yet they did nothing about that. They've got booking documents that directly contradict one another, that they didn't do anything to ferret out why it is that there were distinctions in those documents. So clearly, the way that they addressed her situation was cursory at best, and that, I think, rises to the level of negligence.
Ken, where does the case stand now, and where do you expect it to go?
Well, as we stand right now, on the 18th of February, there's going to be a whole host of motions that are going to be heard by the Honorable Judge Hittner. One of them is that the DPS is making an effort to stay the case because Insenia was charged with a misdemeanor. Our position is that, frankly, that's ludicrous, and the case law seems to bear out our position. But that's something that is going to be argued. In addition to that, DPS has also brought a motion to dismiss, as I've mentioned before, and we're hopeful that we'll get a favorable ruling on that. Likewise, there's a motion to sever the case. In other words, Waller County defendants who have already answered the complaint and are actually defending the complaint are looking to sever the case from Officer Insignia because they don't want their case to wait. But in a practical sense, that makes very little sense because it means that witnesses would have to testify twice in two different lawsuits. The interest of judicial economy would be thwarted, and it costs much more for the parties as well to participate in those two proceedings. So those things don't really make sense. Lastly, because there's a whole host, but just to give you a flavor, there's a motion that we have to extend time to add additional parties, because once we do compel the Ranger report, we're anticipating that we might get information that will lead to or point to additional defendants.
He's attorney Cannon Lambert, Karchmar Lambert, the website getthecannon.com. Get the cannon! Don't forget to get the cannon. Thanks for hopping on with WGN.
I'll tell you from experience, I've had the cannon before against me, and it's no easy task. Cannon's a good lawyer.
Thank you so much for that, sir. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Whiteside & Goldberg Limited is a law firm that specializes in representing injured people in all types of accidents. Whether it be an auto accident, a workplace accident, medical malpractice, construction accident, or slip and fall, the attorneys at Whiteside & Goldberg have a combined 30-plus years of legal experience to represent you. We offer a free consultation and have two offices to serve you throughout the Chicagoland area. If you or someone you know have been injured and you have questions regarding your rights, feel free to contact the law firm of Whiteside & Goldberg today for a free consultation. You can call us at 312-334-6875. And for more information, visit our website at wglawgroup.com.
Legal Face-Off, WGN Plus, Jason Whiteside and Rich Lankoff. I'm Sam Paniatovich. Our next guest on the show, he does a lot of things. He teaches public administration at the University of Illinois Chicago, also at the Stewart School of Business at IIT. He was a lobbyist for four decades. He knows my father, and he has a book out. It's called The Just Cause, The Impeachment and Removal of Governor Rod Blagojevich. He is Professor Bernard Seracki joining us on WGN. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Professor, thanks for joining us. We've covered the Blagojevich case extensively on this show. We've had various guests talking about it, including the ex-governor's brother. I want to get your perspective. You wrote the book that Sam mentioned that talks about the timeline between the time the governor is arrested and the time that he is removed from office. Could you briefly sort of walk us through that process and just tell us what that timeline looked like?
Yeah, I think when it happened, a little over seven years ago now, I was still actively working as a lobbyist, but I was winding down and was about to start teaching full time. And I realized what was happening was probably the most consequential event that the Illinois legislature had ever faced. And so I decided to go to every hearing, every investigative hearing, and I decided to be in attendance at every minute of the trial in the Senate. And I looked around about 4 years ago, and I realized that while there had been some books on Blagojevich, there had been nothing done about the legislative action those 7 weeks and 3 days between the time of his arrest and the time he gets off the plane and they said, "You're no longer governor."
So I just started
to write the book.
Yeah, so explain for our listeners who might not know exactly what impeachment means. It's a term we hear about frequently. What did the Illinois legislature do when they were deciding on impeachment and ultimately impeached the governor?
Very important, and the title of my book is A Just Cause, because that's the only criteria in the 1970 Illinois Constitution. It says for cause. And what it basically does is leave the prerogative up to the House of Representatives if they want to impeach or not. There's basically a two-part process. The House impeaches, and the Senate holds a trial, and the individual senators are the jury, and they decide whether he is guilty or not guilty of the charges that were developed in the impeachment investigation. So there's, it's a two-step process. And I simply was very interested in how they were going to develop the charges. Remember, when he was arrested, he was not guilty of anything. In fact, he wasn't even indicted yet. They had a criminal complaint. It's a very lengthy complaint. It's about 73 pages. But it was just a complaint. And he probably wouldn't be, well, when he was arrested, he wasn't going to be indicted for another 2.5 months. And they had to act immediately. So they, the speaker talked to his general counsel that morning. He talked to John Cullerton, Senator Cullerton, who was the incoming president of the Senate. And they pretty much decided that they would give him 6 days to make up his mind, to resign, to step aside, or to be impeached. And basically, in that six days, they began to impeach or began to prepare an impeachment investigation.
All right. And, Professor, who actually brought that impeachment evidence before the Senate?
A fellow by the name of David Ellis, who is now an appellate court judge. And David was general counsel for the House of Representatives, for the Democratic House of Representatives at the time. And he compiled evidence for cause. And basically that was presented to the House Investigative Committee 6 days later. And the reason that they picked 6 days is because the Illinois delegates that were elected when Barack Obama became president were going to go down to come down to Springfield and go to the old state capitol and formally cast their vote for Barack Obama. So they would all be here. And so the speaker decided that that would be the day that he would announce the investigation.
Professor, bring us inside the chamber during those crucial days. Illinois is the legislature. Both houses are controlled by Democrats. Blagojevich was a Democrat, certainly had his share of enemies on both sides of the aisle. Did he have any support? Did things line up in a partisan way, or was everyone pretty much lining up against him, given that he had, in fact, been arrested?
This, I think, is an important point. It was very nonpartisan. Now, the Republicans certainly were smarting from well over 6 years of being relegated to the back bench, but they both parties conducted themselves in a very dignified manner. They got together. They realized they had to do this. They realized the importance to Illinois and to the citizens of this state. This criminal enterprise that was going on for the past 6 years had to be stopped. And though there was a little partisanship in the trial and a little partisanship during the investigation, I think it was pretty much conducted in a very, very admirable way.
At what point in time did Governor Blagojevich come in and give that very impassioned speech that he gave on the floor?
That's interesting. That was given the last day of the trial. And up until that point, Blagojevich had completely ignored the trial. And in fact, he completely ignored his attorney's advice during the investigative hearings. But he completely ignored the trial. He had a few observers in the gallery, but did not take part. And the day before the last day, he decided that he was going to go in and tell his story. And so he made contact with Senator Cullerton, and they had a meeting and said, well, how are we going to let him come to the trial now? He did not respond per the trial rules. The Senate trial rules, he was given a certain day to respond to the charges. He did not. And now suddenly he wants to come in and make a statement off the record. All right. I mean, not on the record, not under oath, on the record, but not under oath. And so they decided, well, how are we going to do this? And they decided that the Senate could grant leave of the body and allow him to come in. So the last day he showed up to give his speech.
And you might not know the answer to this, but did Rod Blagojevich really think that that speech was going to save him, that that would be you know, overrule all the evidence that was presented against him?
I don't know if we have enough time, but I'll tell you. Can I tell you a quick story?
Sure.
Might give you an idea of the state of mind of Blagojevich. The night before, a gentleman named Clayton Harris, who was his acting chief of staff, because his chief of staff, John Harris, was arrested along with Blagojevich. And Clayton Harris was trying to get the governor on the phone to write a speech for him so that he could deliver it the next day, and could not. The governor was watching television. The governor was eating. He was always busy. Finally, late in the evening, he was able to speak to the governor, and the governor said, "Oh, just go to bed. Everything's going to be all right." And he showed up the next day. He gave a campaign speech that was just outstanding as a campaign speech. It sounds like something you'd see on television, you know, with the primaries going on right now. But did not address the charges at all, did not address his conduct, just gave a speech, made up stories about poor Hispanic women going off into the night and working and leaving their children, you know, stuff, and basically said to the Senate, we all do this. You know, we all have to do this to win elections. And I think with that remark, he pretty much sealed his fate with the Senate. So I don't know what his state of mind was, if he felt he was going to change the mind of the Senate, or if he just felt that he had to go down. I think one of the things that motivated him to come down were some remarks that John Cullerton made the day before. And he told the press, where is he? You know, where is he? Why doesn't he come down here and face these charges? And I think that challenge might have been a motivation for him to come down and talk.
Professor Bernard Ciracchi with us on Legal Faceoff, WGN Plus. You've been a lobbyist for four decades. How much has the game changed from when you started to where you are now? Because politics has gotten pretty crazy.
Yeah, it's gotten a little crazy. I could wax nostalgically about the old days, but I get a feeling that I'd probably seem like an old fossil if I did that. It's certainly changed. The media has changed. The way of communication has changed. I think the conduct and the gentleman demeanor that you had 40 years ago is kind of gone.
You remember playing against Sam's?
I certainly remember played against them.
I don't think I've told you guys this. My dad had a bar in Springfield, which was a stone's throw from the Capitol. Republicans, Democrats, Independents would all come in, and they'd all hang out, right, Professor? They'd all be in there watching the 90s Bulls.
That's exactly right. It was like a procession. When the legislature would adjourn, especially on the late evenings, it was like a procession going over to Sam's, crossing the street.
That explains a lot based on what we know of Sam here. But one last question, Professor, before we let you go. So the Supreme Court recently agreed in January to review the case of the former Virginia governor who was convicted of public corruption. His name was Bob McDonnell. Do you think that, you know, buoyed the hopes of Blagojevich to have maybe the Supreme Court as a last resort review his case? Fast forwarding from your book to the present, what do you think the chances are that Blagojevich, who's now, what, maybe 4 years into a 14-year sentence, getting out before that 14-year sentence is served?
I think the Blagojevich tactics are exactly what landed him in jail for 14 years. The advice that he was given was to be quiet when this happened and not go on national television. Don't appoint Roland Burris to the U.S. Senate, and we'll make a deal. And he ignored that, and I think the same thing is happening again. You know, the appellate court came down with a ruling that discounted, I believe, five counts of his conviction and said to the prosecutor, either try him again or, you know. But it also said that the sentence that was given to him was appropriate. I think instead of now saying I won't appeal anymore, let's see if we can reduce a few years and then I'll get out quicker. I can be eligible for parole quicker. And I think what he's doing is exactly what he did 7 years ago, we're going to fight this all the way. And it got him in jail.
The book is A Just Cause, The Impeachment and Removal of Governor Rob Blagojevich, written by Professor Bernard Saraki, who's a public administration professor at UIC and also at the Stewart School of Business at IIT. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
And welcome back to Legal Face-Off on WGN+. Find us on iTunes, Facebook, and Twitter. You can always rate, review, and share with a friend. It's Rich Lankoff and Jason Whiteside. I am Sam Panionovich, and it's time for our bi-weekly segment on LFO, Inside Out, with Tina Martini, who's an attorney, author, and columnist for she's a chair of DLA Piper, an intellectual property practice group, and her husband, David Sussler, associate general counsel at National Material LP. Good morning to both of you. How are you?
Great. How are you doing?
David?
Good. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for joining us, as always. We appreciate having the Inside Out experts in studio. David, I want to turn to you. Our subject today is staying ahead of the curve. This is the latest Inside Out article from February of 2016 from Chicago Lawyer Magazine. Could be found at chicagolawyermagazine.com. You work in-house as Associate General Counsel for National Material. How important is innovation for an attorney like yourself who works for a company that also stresses innovation? So how does the innovation that your company does translate to the legal world that you practice in?
Well, it's extremely important. You know, as the business is constantly changing and evolving and growing, I have to find new ways and innovate to keep up with the practice, keep up with our changing business, our changing business relationships, the way we do business. So innovation is key in order to stay ahead and keep the business flowing because, again, my job is legal advice in the business context to keep us flowing.
So how do you do that? How do you make sure that you're constantly innovating while also maintaining the day-to-day operations that you have to be involved in? How do you make sure that you're constantly innovating and staying ahead of the curve?
That's a great question. And I think two easy answers. One is to make sure I stay close to the business. I talk as often as I can with the business leaders from every sector of our business to find out what's going on. I keep up on the metals industry as much as I can, and I try to keep up on the law by reading advance sheets, e-newsletters, things like that.
Tina, you guys talk in the article about being proactive too, which obviously for an attorney is very, very important. How do you stay proactive in your practice field?
I would say that we just take a look at what we're being asked to do on any given day, both by our clients as well as by the business, and to try to put our crystal ball in front of us and figure out where are things going, where are they headed, and take it from there. I mean, I think a lot of it is taking a look at things from a process perspective and figuring out from our clients' business perspective, where's their business headed? How do we deliver value to them in any given day, any given year, and figure out how we align what we're delivering to them with where their business is headed?
Tina, we've talked with you and David before about staying on the cutting edge of your clients' needs. How does innovation and staying ahead of the curve align with those goals?
Well, I'd say that we take a look at our clients' businesses and figure out how they are innovating within the context of their businesses and see to what extent their businesses drive legal needs and figure out where those overlaps are. Clients expect their lawyers to be innovating. And innovation is the way that we try to drive as much value into the relationship as possible. It's a way that we eliminate inefficiencies. So I'd say from a legal services perspective, we're looking more at processes of delivering different types of deliverables to clients, whether it's memos, whether it's just giving them advice on a particular situation, and always looking at breaking down the processes into their constituent parts, figuring out where we may have inefficiencies and trying to make sure that we eliminate those inefficiencies.
David, as someone who purchases legal services inside a corporation looking for outside counsel, what are the qualities that you look for in an attorney to make sure that they are innovating. I mean, obviously, you know, when you hire someone from a law firm, for example, to work for National Material, you're not going to know off the bat if they're practicing that's, you know, in a way that's consistent with staying ahead of the curve and innovating. What are the types of characteristics you look for in outside counsel that you think are consistent with that goal?
Well, I think an attorney who does the things that Tina just described is definitely that type of attorney. Somebody who, when you just have a conversation with somebody and you know they're keeping up on the news and thinking about and analyzing, well, what's going on in the world? What's going on in the law? That's where it starts. So I get a sense of the way they think. And then I'm going to look to them to see if I ask them a particular question, because usually I'm going to outside counsel for depth of subject matter expertise. And because outside counsel should have a wealth of expertise that's based on a breadth of clients, to hear how they are able to synthesize all of their knowledge and apply it to my issues. And you know, it's an ongoing evaluation that I use my experience and judgment, but an attorney who's able to do that and take their experience and apply it to my business issue, my legal issue, I'm going to make this judgment call that they're a creative, innovative attorney.
And Tina, with a large law firm and with new associates coming in, how do you counsel the new associates to be innovative or proactive with the workload that they have, and how do they balance that out?
I suggest to them that it's very important for them to try to take the opportunities that they're given to learn about clients and not just look for opportunities to bill hours. So if that means shadowing a partner or senior associate on a file, if that means keeping track of what clients are doing in the news, understanding, looking for ways to understand their business and to also understand that different clients expect different things. So when one client asks for a memo, it doesn't necessarily look the same as another client. So it's really staying close to the partners and the clients who are asking for the work to be done to really understand what those deliverables need to look like and to understand that we give legal advice in the context of a business. It isn't just getting to the right legal answer. It's about understanding the business overlay for all of the advice that we give. So I try to encourage associates right from the very beginning to understand that a big part of client service is not just getting to the right answer, but it's understanding all these other levers that go into the delivery portion of what we do.
It's Inside Out on Legal Faceoff WGN Plus. Tina Martini and David Sussler are columnists. They write for Chicago Lawyer Magazine. The latest article, Staying Ahead of the Curve. Now, it's interesting. They ask you these questions, and then you both have to give in-depth response. Who knocks this out first? Who gets through it first?
Well, I don't know if I want to be the one to answer that.
Come on.
We work on it pretty much simultaneously and separately. We each answer the questions on our own, and then we share them. I will freely admit that Tina is the better writer, so she comes up with a polished, with her polished answers far more quickly than I do.
I before E, except that for C. Just remember that. Never forget that.
Probably a good time to mention to our listeners that Tina and David are more than co-authors, co-columnists. They're married, right? So that probably adds a dynamic to it. And, you know, this being our last legal face-off, I think, before Valentine's Day, even more more potent an issue.
I don't know where you go with this.
Sam's usually the one in this segment to raise the marital issues and, you know, turn this into a marriage counseling session a little bit.
You scared me a little because we've got David, a married couple, Dave and Tina, and then you're looking at me with these longing eyes.
I mean, we're sort of the married version of analysts, aren't we?
Yeah, I guess.
I guess I would be remiss if we didn't end off with a question for both of you. David, you are a world-renowned Bruce Springsteen fan, as we've noted on this show before. Tina is a fan as well, maybe not as fanatic as you, David. You both attended the recent show at the United Center. Can we get a quick review from both of you? I'll start with Tina. What'd you think?
I thought it was fantastic. I thought the band sounded great. I thought Bruce sounded great. I love, from a creative standpoint, watching an artist play an album from beginning to end. especially an album that's as old as The River, because you know that there's a lot of thought that goes into the sequencing of songs. A lot of them are interrelated. You're telling a story. And so I loved that part of the show, and I thought that the balance of the show was terrific. I thought it was a great crowd. I thought it was a great night. I ended up going to the show and having to get up 2 hours after I went to bed to get on a plane to go to Orlando the next day, and I have to say it was well worth getting only 2 hours of sleep for.
For sure. And David, you know, relating it to our topic, Springsteen is what, 67 maybe?
67.
He's been going, wow, doing this for, you know, almost 50 years. How does he stay ahead of the curve? How does he innovate? Tina mentioned that he played an entire album from beginning to end on this show. What are some other examples of Springsteen staying ahead of the curve to make his show still attract, you know, 20, 30,000 people, even at the age of 67?
Well, borrowing from his own words and from a couple interviews I've read with him, he's talking about this tour. He's looking to put The River in a current context. And I think that really comes through in some of the stories he tells in the show. And, you know, he's well aware that this is an album full of deep tracks that only, you know, the most hardcore fans like me or like you, Rich, would get excited about some of the songs that others may not know. But he finds a way every night to get something across to everybody in every corner of every song. And if there's some people who don't like some of the slower songs, well, then he takes a set after he does The River with the big hits. And that's what he does.
I would imagine you both got goosebumps, too. Didn't he do a tribute to Glenn Frey, Take It Easy?
He did.
Yes.
He did. How was that? It was amazing.
It was incredible. Awesome. I'm a very big Eagles fan, and Glenn Frey was my favorite Eagle. And we had gotten reports from people who shall remain anonymous that they were sound checking Take It Easy.
With the whole place.
Maybe one of us in the studio was there six hours before. I shall remain nameless. But, you know, I've seen three shows on this tour, and on two of them, he played a song in tribute to a rock star that had just died. So I'm hoping there's not a Springsteen curse. Luckily, the last show I saw in Toronto, there was no tribute, so hopefully that was it. But
well, Paul Kantner from Jefferson Airplane recently passed away, so I'm not sure if he's playing any Jefferson Airplane.
And Maurice White, too.
Yes,
the most morbid tour in rock history.
Earth, Wind, and Fire. He just passed yesterday.
Yeah, I don't know if Bruce would do a, what's the big Earth, Wind, and Fire song again?
That song with the birds?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I don't know how well they'll play with the E Street Band.
What is it, Boogie Nights or something?
Yeah, they would sound great doing that.
Hey, Bruce covered the Bee Gees on the last tour when he was down in Australia.
That's true.
Alive, so why not?
True.
Why not cover Earth, Wind, and Fire? He's a funky, he's got funk in him.
Always good to talk Springsteen. We get it in on every show with with David and Tina. Thank you. The article this week is Staying Ahead of the Curve on ChicagoLawyerMagazine.com. We'll see you both in 2 weeks.
Great. Thanks
Thank
so much.
Thank you very much.
And we close out Legal Face-Off on WGN Plus with Rich Lenkov and Jason Whiteside. The legal grab bag, as we always do. And we've got a four-pack today. And why not just jump right into it with Bill Cosby? I feel like we've been talking about Bill Cosby for over a year now.
Gives us endless amounts of fodder.
The gift that keeps on giving is Cosby. Yeah, the Cosby news this week was that the judge who is presiding over the civil case against him in Pennsylvania, that's the only remaining case against him given the statute of limitations issues, ruled that Cosby's motion to dismiss the case. He rejected that motion. Cosby said that he had a deal with the prosecutor in Pennsylvania that in exchange for Cosby testifying in the civil case, that the criminal case could proceed. I think I said earlier it was a civil case. This is the criminal case in Pennsylvania. So Cosby said that he had a deal with the old prosecutor, so to allow him to avoid prosecution criminally if he testified in the civil case. Cosby did testify in the civil case. That deposition was unsealed, led to a lot of what we're seeing now. Well, there is a new DA that came in, elected. One of his platforms was prosecuting Cosby, oddly enough, and he said we don't have any such deal. And the judge ruled 2 days ago that the criminal case could proceed for two reasons. He said that it was against public policy for a prosecutor to enter into that kind of deal. He also said that the deal wasn't in writing, so it's not enforceable. The interesting part legally, there's a bunch of interesting parts, but you know, the current DA was cross-examining the former DA, so it was kind of interesting on the stand. But the bottom line is Cosby will now stand trial criminally. There is actually a preliminary hearing in a couple of days to see if there's enough evidence for the case to go forward. Seems like there is, so Cosby case will continue.
So stay tuned.
Good news for
May,
Legal Face-Off, yeah.
All of our episodes coming up will have a Cosby element.
Is there a name legal obstacle here that is holding everything back? What's the biggest obstacle in this case, whether it's on his side or the defendant's side?
Cosby doesn't want a trial. I think that's the biggest thing holding back.
Cosby's money. No, I mean, I think, you know, I was on Bill and Wendy. We were talking about this yesterday. They asked whether the celebrity factor will be an issue. I mean, I think always when you have a celebrity like Cosby, we're going to be talking about OJ in a second. That was a good example. You know, the issue is whether the jury will give him preferential treatment or maybe treat him harsher because he's a celebrity. So we'll see. We'll see how it develops. But I think. I think there will be enough evidence to have him stand trial. And, you know, based on what we've seen, the allegations are pretty strong.
A multi-million-dollar lotto jackpot winner is suing the Iowa lottery, claiming that the money illegally won by Eddie Tipton actually belongs to him.
Yeah, in a case coming out of Iowa, one of the executives for the Iowa lottery was caught actually rigging the system so that he was having him and his friends win money. But this lawsuit was brought on behalf of a winner who you might think actually didn't win money because of this, but he won $9 million and is upset because they're alleging that if they would have caught this Tipton rigging the lottery, then his winnings could have been up to $16.5 million. So they brought a lawsuit, and it opened up this whole Pandora's box with the executive for the Iowa Lottery. And now there's charges being brought, and they're investigating to see whether or not there were other riggings that occurred with the lottery. So he wants his $16.5 instead of $9 million.
I think Iowa was also where that story was involving the woman who said that the slot machine in the casino that paid her like this
a million pennies.
Yeah, she said that she owed the money. So there's something about Iowa and gambling that people
It's also where the primaries are held and
right
great things occur out there.
Need some reason to keep Iowa in the news until the next
Cedar Rapids. The plot to Lucky Numbers with Travolta and Lisa Kudrow.
Good movie,
where they rigged the lottery.
I personally would be happy with $9 million. I don't need to go to 16.5.
Well, and also, didn't the one of the was it the $68 million Powerball winner didn't come forward in L.A. So he or she lost their chance to claim the prize.
He claims that he actually turned in the ticket, and he has a letter from the lottery that says that your ticket was unreadable, so you're not the winner. So he filed a lawsuit now to get his $63 million. Sure, he didn't make the lottery ticket.
I wouldn't have brought that ticket back either. Did you see the crowd around 7-Eleven? It was a madhouse for that lottery ticket. Here's the winning 7-Eleven. And it was just like thousands of people ready to pummel whoever came through.
Yeah.
So, really weird story. There's a Make Rape Legal group, and they're planning a worldwide anti-woman event in 43 countries.
Yeah, there's a... I don't want to say interesting, but there's an individual who has a website that they call, The Return of Kings, and it basically advocates for male dominance and at the hands of pushing women down. I'm trying to couch my words carefully today.
Yeah,
in a G-rated sense, it is an anti-feminist and is for male dominance, but its advocacy is borderline, as the title suggests, on legalizing rape. In certain situations, so,
yeah, and they've tried to organize, you know, these different meetings
secret phrases and passcodes
and like weird meeting places. Like one of them was a playground slider. I mean, just ridiculous. And you know, thankfully, Chicago, along with most communities, have shut it down. I mean, the question is, obviously, you know, where do you draw the line between freedom of association, freedom of speech, and shutting down these things for the public interest.
Yeah, and I mean, it's inciting almost some sort of violence, too. So.
Yeah, for sure.
And they've also banned women from the meetings, so they feel like they can say whatever they want and also keep out whoever they please.
Yeah, it's just ridiculous. Yeah. I mean, thankfully, there is limitations to things like freedom of speech, and this is a good example of a group and an individual that shouldn't even get this kind of notoriety that he's received.
We'll close things out with the O.J. Simpson movie. I don't know if you guys have caught it yet. The American Crime Story, The People versus O.J. Simpson. Cuba Gooding Jr.
Yeah, he's the only one that doesn't really look like the character he's portraying. They did a pretty good job with Johnny Cochran and Marsha Clark. But, Cuba doesn't really look like O.J. But, I think they aired one episode. Did you guys see it? I saw it. I haven't seen it yet.
I saw Travolta's hairpiece. Looks amazing, though.
It's amazing, what hair and eyebrows could do to it.
David Schwimmer doesn't do it for me. Rob Kardashian.
That's the only character I haven't seen on the previous tour, though, is David Schwimmer.
He's got the streak of white in his hair. The first episode was good. I'm excited to see the rest. Brought back some good memories from 20 years ago. The mid-90s.
I read Cuba Gooding Jr. His performance must be Oscar worthy because he said he was exhausted and needed a 3-week break after his performance in the O.J. movie for television.
Back to doing Snow Dogs 3
Pearl Harbor 7? Pearl Harbor 7 not yet? He didn't even change his voice.
No.
Right.
He sounds like Cuba Gooding Jr. I don't understand. But did you catch how somebody said in the first episode that how popular the white Broncos were? After the chase, that was the hottest car in the world to have.
Where were you guys? Bronco. You remember?
Yeah, it just started. It was in the summer of 95, right?
Yes, it was
94.
Was it 94? I remember. Yeah, I was actually in L.A. I was clerking at a firm in L.A. and I was at lunch at Jerry's Deli, which is a mile from where the chase was happening, and we were going to leave and go watch it on the bridge with everyone else, and we thought, lunch is more important. Let's finish this sandwich and check it out. But I was there that summer. It was wild.
Yeah. That was the summer. That was you had Arnold Palmer's last PGA Tour round. The New York Rangers were going through their Stanley Cup parade in New York. The Knicks were in the finals against Houston, and then the World Cup was at Soldier Field, all on the same day, June 18th, 1994.
Tina, where were you for the O.J. For the arrest or the white Bronco or the verdict, any of those?
I was actually in the middle of studying for the bar exam. So I remember coming home from Barbary that day and watching the chase, so to speak, on the expressway.
Yeah, it's one of those moments that you remember. I also remember where I was when they announced the not guilty verdict. Yeah. I was on a bus going to work here
in
Chicago.
Going to Jerry's Deli.
Yeah, exactly. Everything is either Jerry's Deli or O.J. But, I mean, in the city, in Chicago, even though we were, couple thousand miles away from LA, the feeling was pervasive. I mean, you could sort of feel tension.
Everyone was watching the TV. I was a first year in college, and I remember everyone was watching the TV gathered around big televisions, not flat screens.
That you mentioned, I had a little portable TV. Remember those little TVs with an antenna?
Oh yeah.
And I was in the law library at law school, supposed to be studying. I had that little TV on throughout the trial. I mean, it was the trial of the century. Nothing's even come close since then. In terms of big national trials that have gained that kind of attention.
I remember the Tonight Show just abused Judge Ito as often as possible.
Yeah, the Dancing Itos. Remember?
Yeah.
The Dancing Itos were great.
We had some guest on last year that said that they got into law because of the O.J. trial. So you said, the trial of the century probably stemmed a lot of young lawyers in that mid-90s window to get into law.
It was persuading me to get out of the law. I was rethinking my whole career when I was watching
one way
trial.
Or the other.
Yeah, it was probably the first highly publicized TV trial that you could actually see everything go on all, from start to finish on the television.
I mean, again, there's nothing even that I could think of in the last 20 years that comes close.
Nope.
No.
Nope. With that being said, be sure to listen to Legal Face Off on iTunes. You can find us on Facebook, Legal Face Off. Follow on Twitter at The Legal Face Off. Closing remarks, anything?
Let's do a quick interview with our special guests.
Okay. Well, I'll let you lead the way, Rich. Go ahead.
All right, you want to identify yourselves first, guests? Say your name.
Naomi.
Megan.
You want to say your last names too?
You're
going to be famous.
You probably should.
All the people listening.
This is broadcast all throughout the World Wide Web.
Naomi Wild.
Megan McNally.
Emma Lenkov.
Campbell Wilde. Follow me on Musical.ly. Campbell is boss.
All right, so guys, this is a legal show. So we're going to ask you some legal. We're going to do a legal quiz, first of all. Are you ready?
Yeah.
All right, so name. We'll sort of do it like Family Feud style, because I know Emma loves Family Feud.
Okay.
Name something you would find in a courtroom.
Me.
Yes.
A judge.
Judge, very
a table.
Good.
A table.
Emma?
A speaker.
A table.
People.
Table, very good.
People.
Contraband.
People.
Yeah. Oh, evidence. Am I playing?
Survey says
ankle
Sam's
bracelets.
The winner. Guys, what about, do any of you want to be a lawyer when you grow up?
Jury, jury.
Any of you want to be a lawyer?
No.
No.
What do you want to be when you grow up?
An actress.
Actress.
Oh. Actress.
An actress.
And imagine that.
That's sort of like a lawyer.
Okay. All four of them. Look at that.
I pretended right through law school.
Everyone who goes to Agassiz, which is our school, everyone who goes to Agassiz, our school play is Annie.
Annie Jr.
And we want our friend Naomi Wilde to be... to
Sandy.
Be Sandy. So if anyone sees Miss C, then
Or Mr. Hall,
then tell them for Naomi to be Sandy. Please,
we're begging you.
All right, very good.
Also, we need to talk about One Direction. Everyone.
Yes, please. Please like them.
Dave's new song is horrible.
Do not
listen to it.
Do not, because
it was so bad.
Yeah, do not listen to Zane's song.
My ears started burning.
And remember, guys, like Legal Face Off on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, right? All that stuff.
Also follow One Direction. Ever.
That's part of the contract being here today.
Just follow One Direction.
Exactly.
Just post this.
So we can double our listening.
One Direction.
Thank you, guys. Say goodbye.
No. Goodbye.
Bye.
Follow me.
Thank you for joining us.
We'll see you in 2 weeks on Legal Face Off.
Content of this broadcast has been prepared by Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, LLC, and Whiteside & Goldberg, Limited, for informational purposes. This information does not intend to create, and receipt of it does not constitute, a lawyer-client relationship. You should not act upon this information without seeking advice from a lawyer licensed in your own state. In considering prior results, please be aware that each matter is unique, and prior results are not necessarily representative of all matters of Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, LLC, and Whiteside & Goldberg, Limited. You should not rely on prior results to predict future success in similar matters. Please do not send or disclose to either firm confidential information or sensitive materials.